Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Well, it's always fun to talk about birds with Bill Volker. We'll do that today. He's a retired wildlife DNR educator and naturalist, worked at the Horican Marsh for 27 years, and he's been watching birds for 50 years, written a number of books, and has led many bird watching tours. So I hope you'll join in and talk with him as we visit about birds. How do you attract them to your yard? What do you want to know about summer bird watching? Maybe you're just getting into birding this summer. Questions about the tools you might need? Join in the conversation. The number to call is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email, maybe a photo as well, to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Bill Volker, welcome back. Good to have you with us again.
Well, thank you, Larry. Always fun to be able to spend some time with you and your listeners.
Summer really is the time of year when we, I think, have our largest bird populations, is it not?
Oh, yes. And this is certainly also a time of transition in the bird world. So birds, of course, in springtime are migrating, they're arriving. Some are passing through to head further north. Others are settling into their territories. They'll then establish those and hold on to those territories, look for a mate, and raise a family. And this is the time of year now that a lot of those birds have reared their young. The young are fledging from the nest and, of course, added to the population. So right now, we've got more birds at this time of year than at any other time. But also, because they're no longer looking for mates or establishing territories, they're not as vocal. So we've got more birds out there, but it's a little quieter in the woods. Early in the morning, you'll still hear the birds right at that pre-dawn time. But middle of the day, they're just busy taking care of those young, looking for food. You might hear more of the begging calls and the contact calls between adults and their young. So the little chips, chatters, and squawks out there, but not the regular and very persistent singing that we hear in the springtime.
You know, last night I was with a friend and we were at Olbrich Gardens to watch, to listen to a concert. And there was, of course, some large trees there. And the birds were creating a big fuss, and we looked up, you know, kind of through the tree and finally saw a big hawk in the tree.
And were the other birds mobbing it?
Yes.
So they refer to that as mobbing, and they'll actually kind of gather around. They keep their safe distance, but whether it's a hawk or owl, it's maybe a perceived threat. It may not be directly a threat, especially, say, a red-tailed hawk. It's more of a bird going after rodents. It's not very efficient at catching birds. But, you know, they're not taking chances. So they'll sit there and screech at it. And basically, they're just trying to harass it, annoy it, and drive it out of the neighborhood.
I think it was a red-tail, and I think it was just there to listen to the concert.
Yeah,
because they got mobbed away,
being annoyed by everybody else trying to get him out of there.
it took off and it was, of course, being mobbed, but it went right back to the tree, to the safe spot, just sat there perched, looking right straight out at the music.
Well, that's quite a nice sighting.
It was a lot of fun. And, you know, actually this time of the year, most of the young birds have already left their nests.
Yeah, right. Some of the birds start nesting quite early. Well, for example, ravens and crows, I mean, March and early April, you know, they've got their young already starting to hatch out. And our songbirds, most of them are arriving during the month of May. By late May, early June, they're settled in for nesting. And for most of our songbirds, average incubation is, say, 12, 15 days, less than 20 days for most songbirds. And then there's about an equal amount of time that they rear the young in the nest, because remember that they're hatched out basically premature. They're naked, blind, and need to then be reared in the nest for about the same amount of time. So we're talking about a month, you know, 30, maybe 40 days at the most. Well, take a look where we are now, middle of July. Even some of the later nesters have their young out. So there is a little time for some birds to maybe try another family. bluebirds. We know that they'll raise two, sometimes three. I've got a pair of phoebes, which is one of our common flycatchers. They raise their young. They were out of the nest the June 18th, and the female's sitting on the nest right now. She's trying with the second family. Other birds, it's one family a year. If they lose a nest, they may try again, but a lot of our birds, it's a one-time effort for the year. And, of course, for some birds, it may even take them several years before they mature or are successful in attracting a mate. So while there's always that nice addition of young to the population, it's also a challenge. There are nest losses and predation, and there's oftentimes challenges just finding suitable habitat. And then those that do make it to the end of the summertime, they've got to pick up and fly south, some of them going several thousand miles to a place they've never been before, facing new hazards and coming back again. So it's a tough world out there for those birds. But, through good conservation, we give them the space that they need, the opportunities, and hopefully they can persist.
And there you go. Have you seen anything unusual, or were you excited at any of your bird watching this summer so far?
There's always something fun to watch out there. I wouldn't say that I've had anything completely out of the ordinary. There's always a few surprises of things that are less likely than others. Overall, I wouldn't say anything really out of the ordinary. We do oftentimes find in this late summer and coming into fall, this is when some of the rarities show up in Wisconsin. And oftentimes these are birds that don't nest as far as Wisconsin, further south or further west. And then with that dispersal of young afterwards and maybe some of them getting caught up in the winds, they get blown off course. And for the bird watchers, there's oftentimes a chance for some very unusual sightings at that time of year, some of the southern and western birds, such as, say, western kingbirds, other birds coming up from the south, even among the herons and egrets. We see very few of the tricolored snowy egrets or the little blue herons. And they sometimes will make their way up here in that mid-late summer.
Hmm. Let's take some calls. Elizabeth in Columbia County, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I wanted to ask about the orioles. We always enjoy seeing them arrive in May. We seem to have some breeding pairs that are right in our kind of big yards, lots of trees in our neighborhood, so they seem to have families here. I also see them again about mid-August till Labor Day or so, and then I think they migrate. But my question was, what are they doing in that month or 6 weeks where they're not so visible?
Oh, that's a good question. They're probably, if you've got them in your neighborhood nesting, they're probably right overhead. You know, right now the trees are fully leafed out. And as I mentioned at the outset, the birds are a little more quiet, tending their young. And keep in mind, we've got maximum food production right now. The invertebrates, which are certainly a really rich protein fat source for birds, a lot of insects out there, so they're busy feeding. And orioles tend to be sort of mid and upper canopy birds. So in that dense foliage, if they're moving through right overhead and they're not getting out on a visible branch, coming to a feeder where you can see them, or making a little bit of noise as they fly through the opening, you may not even know that they're up there. And that's the interesting thing this time of year. As I said, we've got more birds than any other time of the year, but they're also quite silent. So they may go a little bit unseen.
Well, and speaking of silent or not being silent, I think Tyler's got a call of the Baltimore Oriole. Let's give a listen. There it is.
I try to describe it as a really clear whistle. There's a lot of little variation, but it's that voice. It's very cheerful. He's upbeat. He's got a little bit of up and down with it, but it seems to be a little bit sharper, clearer than, say, a robin's voice.
Yeah. Thanks for that call. Appreciate it very much. Tim in Kenosha, it's your turn. Hi, Tim.
Yeah. Good to be on the show. Appreciate it. We've in our neighborhood, we have a lot of trees, low-density neighborhood, and there, a number of us have feeders out, so we see the birds moving through. And we've noticed, look forward to scarlet tanagers coming through. But there was one pair of Scarlet Tanagers that came through. We're assuming that was what it was, but it had the typical red head, but then the rest of the body was more orange. And it was a pair, and it showed up a couple of our neighbors' feeders. Somebody suggested it might be a northern tanager. Looked that up in Peterson's, and seems like they're the west of the Rockies, so it was doubtful that it was that. But just wondering what your observation is about.
We've got three primary tanagers that you might see in Wisconsin. As you mentioned, the western tanager is an accidental. It's more of a yellowish body with the red head. The scarlet tanager, very scarlet, orangish red with black wings. And then we'll occasionally get the summer tanager. We've had regular visitation and nesting in Wisconsin of them. It seems that the population has been expanding north. The main heart of the population is south of Wisconsin, but we do get them here. And these are birds that really don't achieve that full adult color until that following year. So what oftentimes happens is they should be molting on the wintering ground and coming up in breeding plumage. Sometimes they'll delay that because it takes a lot of energy to migrate. And you may have birds arriving that are barely 1 year old that are still coming into the adult plumage. So they'll look a little scruffy, a little mottled. So both the summer tanager and on occasion you might have the scarlet tanager like that. I've seen this on the summer tanagers.
Oh, the summer. Maybe Tyler, have you got the summer tanager call? Pretty call.
It's a little, I would say kind of sweeter, a little softer than the scarlet tanager. They both have a little bit of this kind of back and forth rhythm to it. It's not a real long song. They kind of do the back, forth a few times. The scarlet tanager is a much more raspy song, and a lot of bird watchers refer to it as a robin with a sore throat. Kind of reminiscent of robin, but there's a raspiness to it.
There's a scarlet, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now listen again here, that raspiness.
Yeah.
Yeah, sore throat.
Tim, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Our guest today, Bill Volker, retired wildlife DNR educator. Questions, comments, I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234. Or you could email us. You could email a question, and if you want to, if you've got a bird photo you want to send along, we'd like that as well. At ideas@wpr.org. Clara Neipert, our producer today. Tyler Ditter's our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. We're talking birds and birding on the program today. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Bill Volker. Great to have you listening in. Let's go back to the phones and take some more calls. Connie in Portage, we'll give you a chance now. Thank you for calling.
Oh, good morning. I have wrens. I have three wren houses out. Two of them are taken, but one just fledged. And then I wondered, if they're acting like they want to build again. How many times a year do the wrens nest?
They will nest once or twice in a year. Being a tiny bird, they have a very short incubation time. And I think it's something like 9 to 11 days. Real surprising. It's less than 2 weeks. Now, of course, birds will lay an egg every day or day and a half, and they don't begin to incubate till the clutch is complete, usually 3-4 eggs. So there's that initial time of the nest building, then to start to lay the eggs. They'll be spending some time in the nest there as the female's in and out. Then she'll sit there, hatch those out, and, of course, raise the young for another roughly barely 2 weeks time in the nest before they come out. Well, that's a pretty short time. That's, less than a month. They can easily raise a second family. Rare to do three.
There you go, Connie. Yeah. Thank you very much.
That's quite exceptional.
Yeah. Thanks for calling. Gina in Madison, we'll go to you. Hi, Gina.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
I live on the north side of Madison, which is very lots of trees and shrubs and things, lots of critters. And the neighbors that I have that all kind of meet in a corner at the backyards all decided that they were going to get rid of their bird feeders to deal with the bird flu. And I think it was hard for all of us initially, but what's happened is that the yards have become a nesting area. And so you get to see birds in ways that you didn't when they were all hanging out at the bird buffet. And it's been really wonderful, and I encourage people to do it if they're reluctant to do so.
Well, Gina, thanks. Comment on that, Bill.
Yeah, you know, bird feeding was normally a winter activity. Things are a little slow. It's extremely bare out there. During storms, it certainly can be important for birds. As we said many times in the past, we do it mostly for ourselves. For the most part, birds don't need those feeders. They just find it to be convenient. More people are starting to feed birds into the spring, summertime. And in summer, they need the food even less because this is just a time of not just peak bird abundance, but also food abundance. So there's a lot of natural food, and there's not really a need to feed them. It's a matter of just luring them in, as we do in wintertime, so we can see them and enjoy them. And sometimes they'll bring their young into the feeders as well. But with the warm temperatures and high humidities, it's even more critical than other times of year to keep those feeding stations clean. So make sure that you disinfect with warm water and bleach periodically, dry out those feeders, and start over with food. You may also want to provide a little less at a time, so there's a little less chance of anything spoiling if you are feeding. Or, as the caller had mentioned, you can just simply shut down the feeding station, let them go about as they naturally have. The main thing is that we just have to provide sufficient habitat, which is not just hiding and nesting places for birds, but also food sources where the insects are harboring for the birds to be able to find the natural foods.
Well, I thought it was really interesting that Gina pointed out that when the neighbors all stopped feeding, that it became a nesting area.
Well, it probably was a nesting area if you have the habitat. It certainly was. I think it's just a matter of watching birds a little differently because rather than that convenience of just staring at the feeder, we're looking more around the yard. So it may be a little bit more of what I'd consider that observer bias. We're looking at birds differently because they're acting differently. They're not just coming to the feeders, and that's where our eyes would probably go, a little bit more exclusively to the birds because it's convenient for them and easy for us to watch them. So you can look around and see a little bit more of a different behavior of the birds in the backyard.
Very interesting. Gina, thanks again. Appreciate it. Let's go to Ernie in Plover. Ernie, hi.
We have a bird bath in our front yard, and I happened to be observing it about a week and a half ago, 2 weeks when it was really warm, and I noticed two oven birds going in the bath and talking to my neighbor who's a more avid bird watcher, and he said that they're more common in the deep woods area, so it was rare to see them in our urban area, and so I've just wondering what your observations were about that.
Yes, very unusual because ovenbird, it is a member of the warbler family, our North American wood warblers, and their main habitat is in the larger mature forest stands. They nest on the ground, so they get their name ovenbird because they build a nest on the ground, and like the old-time ovens, they have little roofs on it and enter from in front. I have never searched diligently for them, but I know this much, that if people who have looked for them, it's just plain luck to ever even find the ovenbird's nest because they do such a good job of concealing them. I think what you had probably was birds that have dispersed a bit from that deeper woods nesting habitat and were moving around a little bit trying to exploit some different food sources. And during the heat, they were looking for a little bit of refreshment and a break, so they found your bird bath a little bit outside of their normal range or territory.
Yeah, interesting. Tyler, have you got the Evan bird call?
Teacher, teacher, teacher.
I get that teacher, teacher, teacher business.
Yeah, and it's a good one to know for that bird because not only does he conceal his nest well on the forest floor, but where warblers tend to be really brilliant golden, yellows, black, and very vivid colors, this one's brown with a little streaking on its breast. Looks like a small thrush.
Yeah.
And as such, he really hides well within the deep forest. So, yeah, we usually pick him out by the call. Best way to do it.
Ernie, thanks. Appreciate the call. Franco in Grand Marsh, we go to you now. Hi, Franco.
Why, hi. Good morning, Larry, and to your guest. My question for your guest this morning is, I feed the neighborhood crows and ravens every single day of the year. My question to you is, how do you tell the difference between a male and a female? The only thing I can see is maybe the size. I'd really like to know that, if you can answer it. Thank you.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a good question. Yeah, the difference between the two, just by visual observation, just shy of impossible. Yeah, it's very difficult. There may be a slight size difference, but it's really not that significant. And I believe there's even overlap in the size. While we're talking, I'm just going to take a look at my bird banding manual. So these are birds in the hand. See if I can find in here. Because the general rule is we need a 95% opportunity to be able to tell the difference between ages or sexes of birds for science, you know, especially birds that are in the hand. And, for birds that where there's size difference, if it isn't, say, 95% of the time one larger than the other, so this is true of many of the owls, yes, female great horned owls are bigger than males, but for the bird banding lab, they don't consider it to be, there's too much overlap to be 100% sure of that most of the time. And I think that's probably the case on crows and ravens, too.
Yeah. You mentioned owls. Jerry in Johnson Creek has a question about owls, I believe.
Good morning.
Hi, Jerry.
Hi. We have had barred owls in our wooded area behind our house for as long as we've been here. But this mm-hmm. year, there seems to be definitely more than one, and when they start up at night, they are just squawking like crazy back and forth. It sounds like a party, and then once they stop and go about seemingly go about their normal routine, then they go back to their normal call. And I'm just wondering what all that squawking is about. I've never heard that before, and it's definitely between two owls, one closer to the house and one farther away.
Okay.
The barred owl.
Yes. Barred owl has the very well-known call. People refer to the mnemonic for it. The way to remember it is, who cooks for you? Who cooks for you all? And then you'll hear a little bit softer, a little more throaty, higher. My assumption has always been that's the female calling back. And this time of year, you'll oftentimes hear birds that just don't have that rhythm. They may do just a screech, or I've heard them do a and I believe these are the young ones that haven't got it down yet. They're still kind of practicing. They're trying their first vocalizations. And so you'll hear that atypical rhythm or lack of rhythm among the birds for the barred owls. So barred owls, of course, like any owl, they're very secretive. They're back in the woods, well camouflaged. And so we hear them quite often, but a little bit more difficult to observe. Even more difficult to confirm for sure that these are the young ones. This is male, that's female call that we're hearing all the time. But I do hear those variations among them. I've got them here in the neighborhood as well. And as I say, most of the year, they've got that very typical, who cooks for you, who cooks for you all. And this time of year, you'll hear a lot of variation among that as the young are coming out of the nest.
Yeah, let's listen to, I think Tyler's already got that song, call up. Let's listen.
One of the easiest ones to remember.
Yeah, it's one of the very easiest ones to remember. Where you all? There we go. Jerry, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. By the way, you can join in, too. We have some open lines to get you on pretty quickly. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or email us, email address ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Let's turn to Beth in Watertown next. Hi, Beth.
Hi. I'm calling because I had a really weird sighting end of May, and I was driving in my car, and my mom asked if there was a big chunk of tar in the road. We drove by it. It was a bird. It looked just like the black top, all black and sparkly. So I pulled over, put gloves on because I thought it was wounded. It was laying there in the road, and it had a really wide mouth. And as I approached it, it just flew straight up, turned around. So I saw the back of its body, and it had a black band vertical on each wing. And it just took off. When I looked it up in a book, it seemed to be a whippoorwill, but I have never seen one of those. It was midday. So I'm seeing if you can help me.
Yes, whippoorwills and nighthawks spend a lot of time on the ground. They nest on the ground, and they may actually sit there for the evening waiting for large insects, especially the moths, to fly by. Nighthawk has a white slash in the wing that is pretty diagnostic. They're both very brown mottled. In other words, they look like dead leaves on the ground, which is excellent camouflage. Yeah, very unusual to see them during the day. Sometimes they'll perch on tree limbs where they're resting during the daytime and then feed around dusk or into the evening. That's certainly what it sounds like to me as a bird sighting. And whippoorwills are really kind of isolated where we find them in Wisconsin these days. A few over along the Lake Michigan shore, more of them in that driftless area in west central Wisconsin, a few hot spots yet where we can find them.
I think we've got a whippoorwill.
Well named for the call.
And then I think Tyler's also got the nighthawk.
Just a buzz.
Yeah. That is a buzz for sure. There
Although
we go.
Getting back to the question on crows here, looking in the bird banding manual, and from one of the researchers, it indicates that using the wing length, the length of the tarsus, which is that large part of the leg above the foot, and the head and bill length, that they are able, with birds in the hand, to distinguish among the sexes 92% of the adults in a population from Saskatchewan. So at least in that part of the country, they said that, yes, they were able to distinguish them more often than not, certainly. So, yeah, there is a difference in size. The problem is, you have to have them right side by side and really kind of look at it and see if there is a one larger individual compared to the other one, larger male, female. So that's about the only way you're going to distinguish it. And even in the hand, for the scientists who do research and capture them, it gets to be a little iffy sometimes.
Let's go to Bill in Lisbon next. Hi, Bill.
Oh, hi, guys. Good morning. I just wanted to add the questioner that called about the barred owls was referring to what we've always called over the years as monkey talk. And you guys did play the normal call for the barred owl, but do you have a recording of the monkey talk when they all get together and squawk?
I don't know. I don't think we've got that one, but Tyler will look around and see. So monkey talk, I'm sure it's not, wouldn't be listed in the Cornell Lab of Ornithology as monkey talk, but.
If it is, that's a new one to me. I've never heard that term, monkey talk. It kind of makes sense, like a bunch of apes just going crazy, that everybody's just chattering and screaming all at once. Oh, interesting. Yeah.
Bill, thank you. If Tyler finds it, we'll put it up at some point. Kathy, wait a minute. I think he might have it. You know what? It does sound a little like monkey talk, doesn't it?
Yeah, good. It's a good term for it. It's a new one for me.
That's a really good term for it. Oh, man. Kathy sent us an email wonders how damaging is community mosquito spraying to our aerial insectivores, purple martins, tree, you know, barn swallows, swifts, that sort of thing.
Well, mosquitoes overall are not a big food source for a lot of birds, especially for the swallows and martins, because they're daytime feeders, and we know in that mosquito hours is as the sun's setting or right after that. The big problem, though, is any of these sprays that we come up with, they're really not that discriminating or that targeting. Sure, we can do something to knock down mosquitoes, but we don't know what other insects out there are also being harmed and suppressed in the same way. So, yeah, it's probably not a good thing because we're not just getting rid of mosquitoes. I think probably the better thing is to use something as a repellent on yourself just to keep them away from you, rather than thinking that by spraying down the neighborhood with something that we're going to kill just mosquitoes and that's going to be it and everything else will be fine. Nothing's that selective. And in a lot of ways, it may be doing more harm than any good. So, no, I would certainly stay away from that. I would just simply stick with a repellent. Or the best thing then is just, right during that mosquito hour, find a screened in the area or just go inside. It's a pretty short-lived. If the temperature drops quickly in the evening, it literally is a little more than an hour. You can go back out again, and mosquitoes have really slowed down.
Myron in Montello will go to you next. Hi, Myron.
Hey, my question is, the other night about 2 in the morning, had the window open, and I was awakened by a sound. It sounded exactly like a siren. And I thought, well, there's something out on the road. And I thought, no, this is too close and too loud. And I've never heard that before. Now I'm on a ravine, and it's wooded here. And I hear a lot of owls. I hear screech owls and other owls. My daughter identified it through her cell phone as a barred owl. And now you were telling me the barred owl sounds like Who Cooks for You. What sounded like a siren, or was that an animal, not a bird?
Okay, it could be a mammal. Certainly rabbits, if they're being captured by a predator like fox or coyote, yeah, they'll wail like a young baby. It sounds like it's a horrific sound from a little rabbit. But the owls will do a variety of screeches this time of year with the young owls. Yes, we may hear a little bit more of a wailing from barred owls and even the long-eared owl, which is far less common or widely distributed in Wisconsin than the barred owl, which is found in almost any wooded area. Long-eared owls also have a variety of vocalizations. So, yeah, I would think it's probably owl, though, you know, there are a number of kind of screeches that we might hear on mammals.
Yeah, we don't have that particular call, but it brings to mind, though, Myron mentioned his daughter's mm-hmm. phone, and there are some apps. I've got a friend who's got an app, and she loves it. She can play this or hear the song, and then the app will tell her what the song was, but what the bird was.
Yes, probably one of the more widely used ones, especially by bird watchers, is Merlin.
Yeah,
Merlin, just like the magician or in like the little falcon, it has a bird song ID on it, and it's really quite good, quite accurate. I was reading something recently that for bird watchers, people who are using it a lot and reporting sightings, the suggestion from the people who are reviewing the rare sightings for Wisconsin is that the app does have some error. It's not 100% foolproof. And so they're encouraging people who are recording or reporting really rare bird sightings or unusual ones to actually record it, use their cell phone or whatever to get the recording. The app, as I say, it can be very reliable. It can certainly help. It's a wonderful learning tool, but it isn't completely foolproof either. So, give it a try. It's probably something that, you know, will get you there 3/4 of the time or more, but don't rely on it every single time, especially when there's something unusual. They're still perfecting the technology.
Myron, thanks a lot. Appreciate it. Kel in Sugar Camp, your turn. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. This is kind of a follow-up from the mosquito thing. 10, 12 years ago, I could go to the Walmart parking lot and sit there and watch nighthawks cruising the lights for insects. I mean, there'd be all kinds of them, and now they're gone. Are nighthawks going extinct because of, like, pesticides?
No, well, we don't know what contaminants in the food chain is doing to those birds. It certainly isn't good for them. But I remember nighthawks, so, you know, we can go back a period of, say, 30, even 40 years ago. I could go to downtown Fond du Lac in West Bend, and they were right in the warm summer evening soaring above the streetlights because the moths were attracted to that. And so that was easy food. They were nesting on the rooftops. And this has also been a bit of a change because in the past, large buildings were built with flat rooftops. There was tar and then gravel on it. And the gravel, well, these are birds that nest on the ground, and that provided a really good nesting spot for them because it was a nice open substrate. They were elevated where they weren't bothered by people or stray dogs. And this was a very common place for them. What's happened is a lot of these buildings found that it was a little bit easier just to use the rubber roof as it is, a synthetic. So now you have a big black plastic roof. Well, that heats up way too much. And the birds, I mean, their eggs are all going to be parboiled up there. So they've abandoned those typical nest sites. So that is certainly one reason why we don't have the urban populations. It's changing in that building technology. So, it'd be kind of nice to see if we could maybe lure them back, if we could encourage people to do the old gravel roof again. It's obviously a little bit more expensive, but you also need a population to draw from. So we still see nighthawks migrating through. We think more of them are nesting further north, that they've abandoned a lot of these places in, say, southern Wisconsin and certainly the urban sites. So, yeah, it's something I don't see anymore. The other question, though, contaminants in their food. I mean, yeah, they are feeding on large flying insects. And whether it's here or if we also find those birds are migrating in wintertime and all over Central America, what are they running into at different times of the year that different people in the United States, in Mexico, and Central America may be applying, and that is contaminating the food chain, and what's the impact? It's a big unknown. It's certainly suspect. But we really don't know for some of these birds what the reasons are, and it may be more than one cause, too, for declines. But, yeah, we don't see them in those areas like we used to.
Cal, thank you very much for calling. Bill Volkert, our guest today, DNR retired DNR educator and naturalist, our guest. And we have open lines to get you on pretty quickly. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us a question and a photo, if you'd like, to ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Talking birds and birding today with our guest, Bill Volkert, retired wildlife DNR educator and naturalist. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining in today. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or phone 1-800-642-1234. Dawn in Chippewa Falls sent an email. She had an interesting story here. She had a male oriole at her grape jelly feeder last week, and Dawn had not turned the dial that day to let more jelly flow out. So the male had to tip his head to access the jelly. It was interesting when the smaller female also perched on the feeder. The male would, quote, eat, but then would feed the female beak to beak. And Dawn had never seen that before.
Yes, we refer to that as courtship of feeding. And it's a little more typical early in the nesting season when the birds are just getting paired up. Probably the most common birds we'll see do that would be cardinal. Very widespread, common backyard bird, and attracted to our feeders. And it's not unusual, especially early springtime, to see the male come in, grab a seed, and then feed it to the female. Whether that is considered to be an offering and breaking down a little bit of the barriers and creating a pair bond, whether he's trying to demonstrate that he's a good provider, or whether it's trying to encourage her and offer some of the extra nutrition. There's a lot of interpretations for the reason for it, but courtship feeding is pretty typical. But more often, it's early on. Now, at this time of year, more commonly, we'll see the parents, of course, feeding their young. Those first couple of weeks when they're out of the nest, sure, they're capable of flying, but they have no real experience of searching for food. So the parents are teaching them at this time.
Hmm.
By the way, speaking of your emails, your producer Clara sent a picture here, and this is from Bobby Hansvik, and the question was whether this photo was of a hummingbird nest. What she has is a vireo. Hummingbirds make a little nest that is actually glued to the top of a twig, probably no more than an inch and a quarter across, and then they'll use plant down and even spider webs. And on the outside, the hummingbirds will glue little pieces of lichen, so it looks like just a bump on the log, so to speak, just a little hump on a twig. This one, this is very typical of vireo nest. It's at the fork of a branch, a lateral branch of a tree, so it's suspended right from the fork, and it's woven there. And what I really notice on the picture is a lot of brown plant material and little white woven in. They may sometimes use things like paper birch or even literally scraps of paper. For some reason, they kind of model this brown and white. So this is a vireo nest. It could be the more common one would be a red-eyed vireo, possible also yellow-throated vireo. They build both a similar structure.
Yeah.
That's what she has.
That's a pretty cool nest. But and you're right about the hummingbird nest. They're so small. I've been just fortunate enough a couple of times to see them in some shrubs that were near the house. And they're really cool to look at. They're pretty small.
Yeah, very small. Yes, they are. It's always a lucky find. Yeah, very, very lucky find for anybody.
Scott in Hayward, we'll go to you. Hi, Scott. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, I've been mountain biking through the woods near Hayward, and I keep hearing this one bird, and I'm wondering if you could help me identify it.
We'll try.
The song goes something like this. It goes, dee 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 dee, dee 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 dee, and I'm wondering. I've looked it up, and I'm wondering if it might be a black-throated green warbler.
Oh, okay. You're giving me the rhythm of the bird, so a couple of high notes, a drop, and up again. The other thing that I always go by is also the quality of the voice, and that's really hard for us to imitate. But the black-throated green warbler does have that kind of a rhythm, so you are right. It's a little bit buzzy call. And they describe it as a zee-zee-zee-zoo-zee.
Hmm.
So that's the phrase they use for it. Let's see if Tyler can find black-throated green warbler. They nest among the pine, mixed pine forests. So especially the northern part of Wisconsin, northeast, and also up in northern Door County. I am in southern Wisconsin. It's a migrant only.
Yeah, let's. Tyler's got one. Let's listen.
Zee-zee-zee-zoo-zee.
Huh. Scott, is that what you heard?
Yep. I didn't hear it. I didn't hear anything. It was just silent.
Oh. Sorry. Did you hear that?
No.
Oh, sorry. I'm sorry. I hope everybody else is hearing it. I'm hearing it.
I didn't hear it here either, Larry. But it is that... as I say, a little bit buzzy. That's why they described it as z-z-z-z-z. There's a little bit of slurred-like to it, but it's a very nice little rhythm for a small bird like that.
Oh, there you go, Scott. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Jerry in Wisconsin Dells has something for us. Let's go there.
Yeah, good morning, gentlemen. Great program as always, Larry. Hey, I know a lot of people put out bird feeders, And I appreciate that, but I took a different tact, and I'd like to advocate for clean, reliable water sources for birds. And this isn't a revelation to anybody listening to this program today, but I got a couple acres northeast of the Dells, and when I was building my modest home here a couple years ago, I realized just what a haven for all kinds of wildlife this area was, but there really isn't any water nearby. And I built a large, maybe 16, 17 square foot in-ground bird bath with varying water depths to about 3 inches, and a big granite boulder, flat boulder in the middle to land on. And boy, what a hit in the avian world that was. I routinely have 7, 8, 9 varieties of birds all bathing and drinking at the same time. I have seen birds I've never seen before, scarlet tanagers, indigo buntings. I still have birds that I can't identify. And I have red-winged blackbirds and eastern phoebes here where they should not be nesting without water nearby, and it's because of my water. And I just like to advocate for anybody in a dry area in the country to consider providing these wonderful tiny creatures with a clean fresh water source. They really love it. Any comments?
Good job.
Great hits. I appreciate that. And well, quite the construction engineering job on your part. For anybody who's not quite that ambitious, even a simple bird bath will do. We get plenty of rain and water here in Wisconsin. We're certainly not a drought-stricken area, but we also right now have those high temperatures of summer. So water doesn't tend to pool very much for birds, and especially out in that driftless area of Wisconsin. It's a lot of river cuts, a very well-drained area by its topography. So standing water is not always that available. We have a little water garden, a little pond that we dug, and there also, I've got a little circulating pump. Yeah, the birds come in, they bathe there. They like to groom themselves, keep clean, and a little drink of water is certainly needed in the heat of the summertime. If you do have a bird bath, a couple of hints for yourself. First of all, yes, the birds will be bathing there, but you may also get droppings, so we don't want to have any buildup of bacteria in that water, especially the shallow ones where it doesn't dilute as easily compared to the caller with his larger one. So you may want to scrub that, clean that out. And, of course, small standing stagnant water is also breeding ground for mosquitoes, which take about 7 to 10 days. So what you want to do is just, you can just with a garden hose, just quick spray it, hose it out, change that water, and start over, and certainly keep it clean like you would with your feeders.
Yeah, Jerry, thanks again.
Yeah, it's quite the attraction. Yeah, it's good for him.
Yeah.
Wow, that's ambitious. I like it when people go out of their way and do that much just for their birds and wildlife.
You should set up a camera, Jerry, close by that where you could record either stills or sort of moving photos, moving pictures of it. It would be really cool to have. Thanks again. Kent in Reedstown, your turn. Hi, Kent.
Yeah, hi. We feed a lot with black sunflower seeds, and I'm just wondering, do birds, can they get dependent on the feeders? Because we get a lot of birds all the time. I'm just filling that feeder all the time. And then plus, I agree with the fellow with the water source. We did kind of the same thing up on a ridge here in the driftless area. And we've got toads in there and frogs now because there's no water around otherwise, and birds of all kinds. So,
no. Very good.
Yeah, that's a good question. Do they actually become dependent on it? I would have to say no. In fact, I've got some good friends and colleagues in Nicaragua. They've got some great bird watching, and these are shade-grown coffee plantations. We take the birding groups there. And I've had a few of them tell me, well, I don't want to put up any hummingbird feeders because those can become dependent. And one person even said, well, they'll forget how to feed in the wild. I have watched hummingbird feeding stations at lodges and these eco lodges and other reserves in many different countries. They are an absolute magnet. They make it easy to see these little things. And we really don't see any negative effects for it. It's mostly a convenience. I always describe our bird feeders like fast food. It's there, it's quick, it's convenient. We certainly don't live on it or depend on it, and we can do without it. And I think the same thing for birds. I sometimes have gone away in wintertime, and my bird feeders run dry. I know the birds will be able to find food on their own. They always have. We do most of our bird feeding for ourselves more than the birds. Sure, they'll certainly take advantage of it, and it may help a little bit, especially during stressful times for survivorship. But for the most part, the birds don't really need it. But if you enjoy birds, why not bring them in where we can keep them close by and actually observe what's in our neighborhood?
Yeah, absolutely. Katie in Fond du Lac, have you got a quick question?
Yes, I have a concern about a tree and barn swallows. Years ago, traveling the back roads and the county roads in Fond du Lac County, you'd see hundreds of them diving for insects over the road. And I haven't seen a single tree swallow this year.
Yes, this is another bird of real concern. And there is a working group. The Wisconsin Bird Conservation Partnership has an aerial insectivore working group they're working on, which includes any birds that are feeding insects out of the air. We mentioned about the nighthawk, the whippoorwills, the swallows, the martins. All of these seem to be under stresses. Now, for barn swallows, again, like the nighthawk, the changes of the building structure, well, barns have gone from the old wooden barns where you had access to the steel closed-in barns. That may have eliminated some of the nesting sites, but we don't know about the quality of the food and what that's doing. They may be under the very same kinds of stresses. We've tried a lot of things to basically declare war on insects, and unfortunately, we're winning.
Yeah, Bill Volkert, our guest, he'll be with us right up till 12:30 today. We're going to take a quick look at the news. We'll find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then Bill will be back to answer more of your questions. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The indigo bunting, little call there that Tyler's using to get us going here in the last portion of our program. Larry Mueller here talking birding with Bill Volker, retired wildlife educator and naturalist, worked at the Horicon Marsh for 27 years, and he sighted almost 4,000 birds, so he knows a lot. And I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you can email us to ideas@wpr.org. Steve in Rhinelander has a question for you, Bill, so let's go there. Steve, thank you for calling.
Thanks for taking my call. I have a question about hummingbird incubation and how many young they normally have. Starting around the 5th of May, I start out with one hummingbird, and I have three, and then five, and then seven, and currently I'm up to 12. I wonder why they dive bomb each other all day long in fear.
I always have a hard time counting the hummingbirds at my feeders because you'll have one aggressive male who's really guarding, defending, and chasing others out, and they buzz around in circles a couple of laps around the house and out through the woods. I don't get them coming at my feeders, say, all at once, so it's hard to get a good count. Normally, the normal clutch size for hummingbirds is two little eggs and two young. And the nesting for them, it's a very short incubation time. I'm trying to remember off the top of my head, and I might just say, check one of my references here. There we go.
Yeah, it's not very
two
long.
Eggs on average, and possibly two broods. So one to two broods is really the main thing for them. So once or twice in a year. And it's reported at about 14 to 16 days where so a small bird is a little bit longer incubation period. That's what I thought. There was a little longer than you might expect for a little bird like that.
Mm.
But basically about 1 month's time. So from the laying of the two eggs, 14 to 16 days, then feeding the young roughly equal amount of time, and then maybe a second nesting attempt in the summertime. And for Wisconsin, if you think about them arriving here, usually that first week of May, by say the second, third, certainly fourth week of May, they should begin. So June, one family, possibly before the end of July, a second family. But it's not always a lot of time for them, because you also have to consider that not only they have to raise their young, but they've got to be full grown, independent, and pretty mature before the end of the summer, so that they can head south too. So there's also that timing. Can they actually bring those young so that they can survive and make the journey?
Yeah, yeah. Steve,
that becomes a limiting factor.
Steve, thank you. Appreciate it. Bruce in La Crosse, on to you now. Hi, Bruce.
Yes, hi. I live right off the Mississippi on a slough, so I'm on the water. I have a typical light green and white Martin house. It's made of aluminum. I've had it for 25 years. Initially had several years of productivity with the Martins. Recently, there has been none. Neighbors all have Martins, or most neighbors have Martins. Last Friday, two, a male and a female, came and sat on the house and looked around and twerped and left. What am I doing wrong since a couple of years ago when I had Martins?
I don't know if you're doing anything wrong. I think the best thing to do is keep that Martin house up, certainly keep the unwanted guests out, which would be the house sparrows and starlings, if the starlings have access. Nowadays, the holes are sort of oval-shaped and smaller, which tends to exclude those birds. And why you would have had them for so many years and not have them this year, that is difficult to say. Hopefully, if the neighbors have them, that they're, you know, doing well, raising young, adding to the population, and maybe as they come back and are looking for if there's more birds than available apartments for them, maybe they'll take advantage of yours again. The one thing I do know about purple martins, which is typical of any colonial nesting bird, is colonies are easy to lose from a variety of reasons, disturbance and changes in the environment, but they're very hard to attract and start again. Best thing to do is get that Martin house up, leave it there. As I said, keep the unwanted guests out, and hopefully you can lure them back again.
Yeah, maybe take a look.
Good luck with that.
Maybe take a look at what your neighbors' houses look like, and you know, maybe there is something about the opening or whatever of your house, because yours is 25 years old. It may be that
the other thing is as I said, changes in habitat. As trees get to be too close, they've got to be out in the open. So yeah. Usually say a minimum of 30 feet from it, and I think certainly more than that. They want a good open sweep, so don't let those trees get too close. Maybe take a look there. Do you still have that larger open physical space around the house?
And Tyler's,
yeah, good luck.
Tyler's got the purple martin, I believe. Call. That was a cool call.
Yeah, very chatty, and sounds like more than one individual, so I'm sure that was recorded right around a Martin house where we've got a colony of them.
Yeah. Bruce, thank you again. Appreciate the call.
Yes, and good luck.
Yeah. Eric in Oneida County, on to you now.
Oh, Larry, thanks for taking my call, as always. I'd like to comment the guest to give me an opinion. Every spring and every fall, the most impressive part of the migration for me is the cranes. That when they come through, their haunting calls, and it's just a way of life up here that I find so peaceful. And the recent Continental Congress had a question about hunting cranes. Now, I'm not sure exactly what the final verdict was on that, but I just find it very hard and difficult to understand the purpose of turning that bird into a trophy. I really haven't seen any crane on the menu lately at the local grocery store. So just his opinion on what that's all about and what he thinks, why that would serve any purpose.
And it was the Conservation Congress, and I'm not sure how the vote went on that.
Yeah, I'm not sure either, but it was an advisory question. Yes, it was Conservation Congress, Continental Congress was a little bit before that time, but that's okay. It's quite controversial now where we get the big population of cranes. You know, people go out to Nebraska to see them along the Platte River. That is a different subspecies. That's the lesser sandhill crane. They're a little bit smaller. Population numbers at least 750,000, 800,000 birds in that population. And there is hunting in a few provinces of Canada, the Dakotas, Nebraska, Texas. So some of those states have had a hunting season. Wisconsin is home to the greater sandhill crane. Populations certainly have been growing over the last few decades. So we do have more of them. In terms of just raw numbers, it could be a huntable population if it's well regulated. In other words, there's enough we could take a few without harming the population long term. But to me, the question is not can we, but should we? And especially considering the fact that Wisconsin is the location where we are reintroducing whooping cranes. And yes, for whooping cranes and sandhill cranes can be pretty easily distinguished, but to me, even sandhill cranes sometimes look quite white in certain lighting. And as everybody else who's maybe not as watchful of birds as I am, able to distinguish them 100% of the time? Is there a chance for misidentification? We know that whooping cranes, there has been shooting of them in other states. That is federal crime. You won't see them, by the way, on the menu or any of these birds because you cannot harvest wild birds for food and sell them. You can certainly do so for game birds and take them home yourself, but cannot be sold because the federal laws prohibit that. That was the end of market hunting back in the 1800s, early 1900s. It does remain controversial. And as I say, to me, the question always is, not a matter of just the biology. Can we hunt them? Sure, with good regulation, you could. But should we, and is it going to be something that we can say that we can also safeguard the whooping crane population? And I do have some serious reservations over that. I share that with you.
Let's listen. We've got the songs. Tyler's got the songs for both the sandhill and the hooper. Sandhill, let's try them first. Yeah.
That's a single bird. We will get the duetting between male and female. And whooping crane.
Yeah, have you got the hooper? Interesting song.
Yeah, a little more cackle, a little bit more of a rise to it at the end. You know, the other concern I have also about, is there even a necessity of having to open a season on cranes when we don't even have enough hunters to do an effective job of suppressing a Canada goose population, which we've got plenty of. We've got a declining number of hunters, and we've got abundant opportunities between some of the more traditional birds. So to add another one in there, I don't think we're really providing anything that hunters haven't already got available for themselves for hunting without creating some controversy between the non-hunting community. And in my mind, we need hunters, bird watchers, and non-hunters, nature lovers all together to join for good conservation. We've got enough things that we share in common and need to work against. We don't need to divide those people among controversial issues like this. So there's another social aspect to this whole question.
Eric, thank you again. Appreciate the call. Annette in Green Bay, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Annette.
Yes. Hi, Larry and Bill. Just three things I wanted to say quick. The idea of water baths and whatnot for birds. I saw a hummingbird actually taking a bath in a three-tier water fountain that I have next to the house, and I've never seen a hummingbird taking a bird bath, so that was really amazing. So water is so important.
Mm-hmm. Was he doing it on the wing, dipping with his breast in the water?
Yes, everything. It was just like the robins and everybody else do, so I never knew they took baths.
I've even seen them fly through sprinklers. Taking a shower instead of a bath.
Yeah, that's a good way, too. The other thing is we have three nesting purple martins, and their song and everything is just beautiful to hear. So we are so lucky to have them. And lastly, I don't know if you mentioned this or not, but how the importance of insects and caterpillars to the bird population. You know, we all do a lot of seed feeding in the wintertime, but in the summertime, they need insects and they need caterpillars for protein and food and all that. And we should do everything we can to make sure that the insect population stays healthy for our birds rather than just indiscriminately just, you know, spraying, killing everything. I don't know if you mentioned that, but if you could, I'd appreciate it.
Sure. Also, research is indicating that not only are we having some serious impacts on insect populations in general, but for your own backyard, it seems that our native insects, which are the primary food for the birds, that they do much better on native plants. And of course, that would make sense that they evolved with those plants here in North America and that the two have found somewhat of a compatibility in terms of the food source for one and being a food source of insects for the birds. So as we have the non-native invasives come in, it seems that they are not very conducive to our native insects. So you may have green in your backyard, but it may be a bit of a biological desert that these plants are not providing that nutrient food source for the insects, which will be luring in the birds. So, yeah, go native. Definitely work with your landscapers and try to control some of those invasive shrubs and try to plant natives there, because that is not just general shelter, but it's a really critical shelter that the insects need.
Yeah, absolutely. Annette, thank you very much. Lee in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Lee.
Yeah, hi. I would like to ask Bill if he knows if there's still the Purple Martin houses that were marketed that are aluminum, and I think it was Purple Martin Junction years ago, if they're still around.
I'm not aware of that. There's a number of the wild bird centers and places like that, and even online you can find some good Martin houses. My main source for information has been the Purple Martin Conservation Association. They're out of Pennsylvania, and there's some really good hints for what they refer to as the Purple Martin landlords, people who've got the houses and are hosting birds, how to set them up, the kinds of boxes and or gourds to buy, one of the two, either a compound house or a gourds, how to manage and maintain them, how to keep the house sparrows and starlings out, how to monitor those boxes. And one of the unfortunate things that I've noticed with some of the older Martin houses, sort of the wooden ones that people put out and just leave out year-round, is the house sparrows get into there and people are reluctant to do anything. I've talked to one or two over the years and, they'll be fine. You can't have them both. It's going to be one or the other, and more often than not, it's going to be the house sparrows and the starlings that win out. And it's the lack of intervention management that we've actually lost the number of these colonies. So what we need is people who, first of all, have an area where they have a good chance of luring those birds in, those who really make a conscientious effort to keep the non-natives out and try to manage for those birds, and really take good care of them. Because in the eastern United States, Purple Martins are 100% totally dependent on human housing. Out west, they still are using some of the old big dead trees, but even there, it's not the majority of the birds. They need us, and we need to provide that housing for them and manage it properly.
Joe sent us an email about martins, as a matter of fact. He says the closer you can get the house to water, the better. Joe's best results have been putting the house up at the end of his pier.
Yes, they do like to be near or even just about over water. It's that open sweep for one that they like, and of course there's a lot of insects. It doesn't mean you have to be. I've seen a number of them that are quite a distance from water, but are open, say some of the nice farmsteads, open land, and there's still insects over the food and over those open fields, insects flying around in these open areas. But again, as we said earlier, you need that open aspect. And I've also seen as trees get bigger and mature and they close in a little bit, the martins don't like that. So we need to have that open aspect around it. Yeah, water is always nice, but not everybody has that opportunity. It doesn't mean that it's impossible to lure them.
Brian in Elgin, your turn. Thanks for calling.
Hey, I have a question about finches. And I have a double tube feeder that I put the thistle in.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And at any given time, I'd have like 12 of them. And in the wintertime, there's no color to them. And all of a sudden, the spring came around, and there's 12 variety of colors hanging on it. And all of a sudden, they just disappeared.
Well, what you have is the finches are flocking birds. So they move around in wintertime as flocks. So this is why we can easily lure them into a backyard. And as you said, you're not going to get just one or two. Most of the time, you get a whole bunch of them coming to you. They like that closeness. But when it comes towards springtime, they're getting those bright colors. They're now selecting mates. And now is when they're spreading out for mating and nesting season. So the flocks are breaking up as individual pairs. And, of course, with a lot of natural food out there, they're not as likely drawn into the feeder. So, yeah, I also have not seen goldfinches around my feeders for weeks now. But, there's plenty of natural food out there.
Yeah.
So, yeah, they tend to disperse at this time of year.
Thanks, Brian. Gene in Ironwood, Michigan, your turn. Hi, Gene.
Hello. Hi. Speaking about the finches, I had mobs of them this spring when they were migrating, and then most of them just disappeared, but there had to be hundreds of them. And all I had out there were two feeders. And my question being about another bird, it's about the size of a cardinal or a blue jay, and it's all black. When it spreads its wings, it has really pretty designs in the white feathers. And then the tail feathers are like a golden orange color. Otherwise, it's black. And I found that in the snowbank by my driveway where they go by with the plow. And this was probably March or April at that time. Hmm. And the only reason I've seen it is part of the feathers were sticking up out of the snow.
Yeah. Any idea on that one?
I'm racking my brain. I'm trying to picture her description of it. I'm not connecting with anything. Maybe a caller's got a hint and getting a little better image than I am. Nothing is coming to mind right now.
So probably a good place to, where should she look? What book should she look?
Well, I like the Peterson Field Guide, or, you know, there's a number of good field guides. Sibley's another one. I recommend anybody who's got a bird feeder to get a nice bird book. There's a whole variety of things that are available out there on the shelves. And keep something nearby the window. As you get more familiar with the birds and with your book, it gets a lot easier to find them and to sort them out. I have the same thing I go through every time I go traveling for bird watching. I may enter a country where everything is new, and I've got to start from scratch just to learn the families and which ones occur in an area and start to figure out how to sort them out. And same thing for people starting in their own backyard, but that's the place to start.
Yeah, for sure. Well, we got a nice email from Joanne in Monona. Joanne was sitting on her front porch listening to our program today when Tyler played the Tanager songs. And immediately after, a tanager responded from the trees across the street. She had no idea they were around here.
You got another listener, Larry. Even the tanagers are listening to the show. Great. That's wonderful.
I love that story.
That bird watching easy, huh?
Yeah, and then the fact she didn't know that there were any around. It was It was a great surprise.
To listen to Larry Mueller's show, right?
Bill, it is always a pleasure. I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. It's always a lot of fun, and I hope you'll be back, and you'll be with us again.
Anytime it works out for us, Larry. Thank you so much. Thanks to all the listeners.
Bill Volkert, retired wildlife educator and naturalist. He worked at the Horicon Marsh and has sighted almost 4,000 species of birds. Isn't that something? Yeah, he really knows his stuff. It's always fun, and we'll get him back, and we'll do this again. Coming up tomorrow on the Larry Mueller Show, we're talking about solar panels and your home. We'll cover how to get them installed, plus look at trends in the solar energy market. That's tomorrow at 11. In the meantime, thank you for listening, and stay with us. Watson Store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.